Thanks very much, Ed, for the introduction and for the invitation. It's a pleasure to talk about Henry James with people who've been reading and thinking about his book. What I'm going to do is present a brief version of the interpretation of James I defend in the book, and then talk about it specifically in terms of Portrait of a Lady. The interpretation has two essential components, which I'll describe very briefly and then turn to the text. Unfortunately, for those of you who haven't read the end of the novel yet, I'm going to ruin it for you, because there's no way I can construct an interpretation of the book without talking about the ending. Because I'm particularly interested in what I call in the book modern moral life, or the presentation of moral issues by James. As many of you who have finished the book know, the most important issue in the book is a deception. Madame Merle and her former boyfriend, Gilbert Osmond, pretend to the newly wealthy American, Isabel Archer, that they are simply casual friends, both interested in her, but actually this is a kind of strategy to get Isabel and Osmond married so that her daughter, Pansy, who is also the child of Madame Merle and Osmond, will receive an extremely wealthy dowry. Isabel receives £70,000, the equivalent of several hundred million dollars at the time, from a wealthy American who leaves it to her at the request of his son, Ralph Touchett. She becomes immediately one of the wealthiest women in Europe, and Madame Merle, who had this adulterous affair with Osmond years before, of whom Pansy is the issue, conceives this plan to get them together and marry them so that her daughter can have a lot of money as a dowry. This is, of course, a deceit. It's experienced in the novel as a deceit, a bad thing. And what interests me in the discussions of the novel and critics is what I didn't find, actually, was a sufficient explanation of what it was about this act that was wrong. Not simply as a psychological fact about the people in the novel, that they regarded it as wrong, but what is it about the deception that James thinks makes it, as a human reality, wrong? This interested me because James, if you've read anything else by him, there isn't in Henry James a very large or firm context for morality. There's no religion in James, in all of the books and novels. There's not a character who believes seriously in religion. There's hardly any sort of serious interest in politics. There's one novel, The Princess Casamassima, in which a young man becomes interested in the idea of political revolution. But it's treated by James as just a kind of sidelight to the larger issues he's concerned with. And as a matter of fact, the thing that makes this even more puzzling is that the world James presents in his novels is a kind of very self-consciously and resolutely modern world. And James, like many late 19th, early 20th century novelists, poets, artists, conceived of the emerging world of Western European modernity. A world dominated by the authority of natural science, market economies, private property, mobility, social mobility like never before, as one that was primarily experienced by the sensitive souls of Europe as loss, the loss of tradition, the loss of religious orientation, the loss of meaning in general. And James is one of those people. That is, the books are mostly about, as the central human reality that people have to be concerned with, money and marriage. As I say, they're resolutely modern characters. They don't worry about philosophy, the truth. Some of them worry about art. That's something we could talk about independently. And some of them are very important characters in James. But the interesting thing in the novel is that most of what's significant for the characters is how to get money and keep it, and how to get married, stay married, avoid marriage, get out of a marriage, and so forth. And of course, very often these two things intersect. For most human beings on the planet in Western European societies, the great struggle for existence is over. That is, the great day-to-day struggle simply to stay alive. The great sort of political struggle of the emerging nation states of Europe and the wars of religion are over. None of us are brought up to be participants in a great religious war, or to be participants in a war of any kind, we hope. However, that means we may not achieve the glory of past civilizations. Mostly what we're interested in as you're going through school and thinking about your future life is what the characters in James are interested in: money and marriage, or a relationship of some sort. How are you going to get enough? how are you going to find somebody you can abide to live with the rest of your life? Perhaps you might shoot higher than that. But in general, the world James presents in his fiction is very much like the world we're familiar with. But perhaps some of you are more religious, perhaps some of you are more political. But by and large, there isn't anything reflected in the world that would explain on the surface what makes this deception bad. And actually, almost all of the very serious James novels have as their center plot issue a lie or a deception like this. In The Wings of the Dove, an American heiress who is dying meets a young British couple who haven't the money to get married, to live well. If you don't have enough money to get married, to live well, you don't get married. They conceive the idea of having the man make love to the heiress, marry, and then after she dies, which will be soon, they'll have all the money they need. That's the plot element around which everything else turns in The Wings of the Dove. She finds out about it and is crushed and dies immediately of grief. And again, the issue is, what's wrong with the deception, particularly if it had succeeded? If she had died in blissful happiness with a man she believed loved her and she believes was meant for her, much happier than she would have been in the miserable, short, sick life that she had. James unequivocally presents what they're doing as wrong, that this character was entitled to a treatment she didn't have. Likewise, in The Ambassadors, a man is sent by his wife-to-be, man in his 50s, to Europe to rescue her son, who is in the clutches of a European adventuress, a married woman with whom he's been having a long affair. He's supposed to stay in Europe 6 months, he stays 6 years. The family's getting a little anxious, sends this man out, the ambassador, to get him and bring him back. And again, when he asks what the nature of this relationship is, it's sworn to him that it's platonic and a merely educational relationship. That's a lie that turns out to be not wrong in the complicated moral universe that James presents. So anyway, I wanted to try to figure out what, for James, the meaning of modern morality was. Why is a deception to be avoided, even if great benefit occurs? Why is the manipulation by Madame Merle and Osmond in this book of Isabel, their deceit of Isabel, wrong? What's James' view of it as wrong? Because I became convinced that it's not simply that the characters in the book believe it's wrong. James himself thinks that part of the moral furniture of the universe, if you like, some real aspect of the lives we lead, is that actions like that are morally unacceptable. They're to be rejected. We're obligated to avoid them. You cannot treat someone as if they are not an equally entitled free subject, but merely the means for your success or happiness. Well, that's the idea of the book, how to figure that out. With The Portrait of a Lady, this becomes even harder because it's even clearer in the book that James believes the sort of standard traditional ways in which we understand this problem have been breaking down. And this is largely a function of the most famous theme in all of James's fiction, the international theme. There are several major books in which the major characters are Americans and Europeans, sometimes British, more often French and Italian, in the larger books. And this reflects James's historical sense of the emerging modern world. The Americans tend to represent what's coming. The Americans in James's book are about to take over the planet. And there have never been people like Americans before. And James is quite interested, as are the sophisticated Europeans, with what James will make, what Americans will make of the new economic power that they have. Europe, the old system of European tradition and culture, cannot finance itself any longer. It's going broke. It's powerless, weak, a mere social theater. And the traditional moral values and assumptions behind the old European system for the aristocrats, convent education for girls, arranged marriages, fixed social classes, very limited social mobility, repetition of the cycle of social and cultural life within your class, something Americans are quite proud of having broken out of increasing social mobility between economic and cultural classes. Well, the system of fixed social class, inherited privilege, lack of social mobility, arranged marriages, convent education, all of that, James thinks, the sort of significance of tradition that allowed Europe to understand itself is breaking down. And the Americans arrive on the scene, and so this contrast between American and European is treated by James as a great historical event, perhaps one of the most significant events in the history of the world. That is, the aristocratic tradition, which suffered its first blow, of course, in early modernity, the French Revolution, the denial of the ending of feudalism, of feudal privilege, and so forth, has finally come to the point where its actual social glue is rotted, and the entire enterprise is falling apart as these would-be European princes desperately seek American women of means in order to preserve the kind of cultured life they feel entitled to. So within this context, that is, a decayed Europe and an uncertain future in America, the question James answers becomes even harder to ask. You may have noticed in this book the characters, perhaps in James all the way through his literature, if you've read other parts of this book, the characters have a great deal of trouble understanding each other. You may have found it a difficult book to read at the beginning because the layers of possible meaning are so complex that it never seems that two people are having a conversation. Rather, subject A is thinking, B will take what I now say to mean C, but then he will see that I take him to mean C, and I therefore will say D. But then, of course, he could take me to think I might take it as D, etc. This feature of James' fiction drives people crazy. And one of the reasons he's not a popular novelist is that he lays it on so thick. That is to say, he introduces you to so much ambiguity in just what a simple event or a simple state of affairs would mean that he makes things, it seems, much more confusing than they need to be. So likewise, in this event, although the events are of momentous significance, the question raised here is, what does it mean that Isabel marries Gilbert Osmond? What does she want? What does she expect from the marriage? What does she think she's doing? Turns out to be very hard to state as a matter of sort of formed intentions. That's what's kind of mysterious about the book. If you're reading along and Osmond just seems to you like a sort of standard European aristocrat, you're going to be surprised by what a rat he turns out to be. But there are plenty of indications early on that not much is known about him, that he's kind of a cipher. And so the question that James asks of Isabel is a pertinent one for her. What does she get out of the marriage? But it's also a question he's raising within modern society. Marriage is a very old tradition, after all. And the sort of symbolic covering of the tradition that we're still quite comfortable with indicates how old we take it to be. Namely, women get married in the United States mostly in white, virginal, medieval princess dresses. Is essentially what they are. Women dress up as medieval princesses in a dress they will wear for no other occasion in their life except when they marry. But the meaning of this ritual is odd. Why do we do that? I mean, when this comes up in various contexts in my classes, I always ask my women students, how many of you want to be married in a traditional marriage? Virtually 90% raise their hand. That means you want the dress with the long train and the hood thing, yes. Why do you want that? Well, it's important. It means something that the marriage reflects a tradition that goes back over 1,000 years in the West to dress that way. That means it's part of a recurring pattern of civilization that you want to be part of. It's not just a legal document between you. But actually, by modern standards, what is a marriage? It's a legal contract between two parties that has about as much magical or mystical significance as, for some people, an appearance before a city clerk. Right? This is only one of the many aspects of the problem of how a secular view of modernity, of self-interested, rational agents attempting to negotiate with each other, makes many of the questions James is asking about morality and meaning very difficult to ask. They don't seem to have a firm place. I have a presentation I'm going to talk my way through, so periodically I will simply thumb through these. A second thing about this historical dimension. Is it all right if I move around, or is that driving you crazy? It's all right? Okay. James is regularly believed to have been a party to the conservative side in this debate. The traditional reading of James is, here come the vulgar Americans, loaded with money, classless, tasteless, heartless, greedy, consumerist, utilitarian, pragmatic, ugly-loving Americans. And here are the Europeans, refined, full of taste, like James himself, who left America for England, and presumably need Americans only to refinance their system. This is an extremely superficial and misleading picture of James, although it is a very, very common one. You can see in Portrait of a Lady who is the best character in the book, the most admirable, the most likable, the most interesting, the most intelligent. There's absolutely no question it's Isabel Archer, the American. Who's the worst character in the book? Osmond, the worst character in all of James. A snake, she called, a serpent in the grass, Gilbert Osmond, who, while an American, is an ersatz, a fake European. Perhaps he has to be fake because there really isn't the Europe he wants anymore. He has to pretend. He pretends to be an Italian prince, is essentially what he pretends to be. And the idea of associating James with such a character seems to me ridiculous on the face of it, although it's very common to think of James as one of these conservatives. It's almost always true that the most interesting characters in James, the ones who seem to have appreciated what the new sort of modern social situation calls for, are Americans. That is, those who have not the burden of the weight of European tradition and social immobility to weigh them down, to make it hard for them to understand what's going on. One way, so we get to the situation, all right, we've got moral crises, people doing things to each other that we feel are somehow inappropriate, and we want to understand why. We look in James to what usually serves as the foundation of moral judgments, religion, tradition, community standards or something. None of that is there. These people seem isolated from their communities. I mean, think of the Touchetts if you read far into the novel. These displaced Americans, this banker living in England with in a completely loveless marriage with his wife. Isabel, we'll talk about most of the characters in a minute, but the situation that James plunges them in doesn't seem to have many resources for their figuring out what to do, what ought to do. This is particularly true of the one element absolutely crucial for moral understanding, and that's the problem of meaning. That is, negotiating what it is we're doing with each other under a common view of what we're doing. Presumably all of us have some description of what we're now doing. Listening to a talk about James, wasting time, doing this because my mother said I had to, or there's a variety of descriptions one could give of what we're doing. But as the issues get more serious, we have to agree much more seriously about the various descriptions that we exchange in explaining ourselves to each other. And if the conventions, the normal categories and rules by which that is done have begun to break down, then it becomes significantly harder for us to understand what it is we're proposing to each other that we do. This is certainly the case with the issue of marriage. And very often with James, it's an issue that comes up constantly with the characters' interchanges with each other as they try to figure out what it is they're pledging each other, they're promising each other. Take the issue of marriage again, which is a central one in human life, but in which the issue of what exactly we're promising ourselves to each other to do has become extremely obscure. The idea of understanding the bond under the concept of sacredness or divinely sanctioned, even if we're, you know, sort of Sunday religious, has pretty much disappeared. The idea of the institution being understandable mostly religiously. Most of us don't understand it religiously. The idea of it being a kind of community institution that we can't do away with without leaving our community has also gone. Most of you will probably not stay in this community. You go away to college, you'll probably never come back, ever. Almost all of you, probably. And so the idea of reenacting a community ritual for the sake of a common inherited, that's gone. So the simple question of what it means to marry someone, that is why you're doing it, what you want out of it, how you would describe it, and how we could understand each other, given that we both don't rely on something else we take for granted anymore, is what makes James' novels always filled with conversation. That's 90% of the novel's real meat. Is in conversations between people about just this issue. sometimes conversations inside themselves, like Isabel's famous night long. She stays up one night by the fire when it suddenly occurs to her that everything she's been believing is a lie. That conversation is also as she tries to talk herself through what's happening. So that last theme, I mean, if the issue's straight, namely, how does James convince us that a moral act is to be considered moral or immoral? How does he do so in the context of this altered situation of modernity without the traditional supports? How does he especially help us understand the commonality of meaning we need to negotiate in our lives and assess and judge them together? He also seems to suggest something very common in other theorists of modernity, and that is the way the lives of these characters are so interlinked, so much a matter of dependence on each other, not just material dependence, although that's there, but dependence on the reflections and ideas of others to help you understand what it is you're doing and saying. That's another reason why these Jamesian conversations are so complicated. People are trying to figure out not just what they mean, but how what they say means in the mind of another, because that's part of how you know that what you think you mean, you do mean. Right? We've all known people, the simplest example, who think they're great opera singers in their own mind, and they're incapable of seeing in the pained faces of others that they're not a great opera singer, where that means nobody else thinks they are. You only get to be one by being taken to be one. And this issue of mutuality and dependence is a crucial one for James, as it's expressed in a variety of ways by characters who are either resisting it or accepting it and exaggerating it to too great an extent. That's what the Europeans do. They think that this dependence on form, on how things look, on not breaching social etiquette, is part of what it is to be a civilized person, because you reflect back to each other the virtues of civilization you hold, whereas the Americans are always breaking through it. There's one very fine exhibition of this in Portrait of a Lady that occurs about a third of the way through that I want to cite as an example of this, the depth of the issue James is introducing about the issue of morality. To settle that, we have to know how to settle the issue of meaning, of how I know what you're doing, what you intend, of what it is we're doing, how we settle that. Here's an exchange between Isabel and Madame Merle. Isabel had just remarked about what had been called someone's supposedly ugly brick house. "I don't care anything," Isabel says, "about his house." She dismisses this outer stuff. Madame Merle replies, "That's very crude of you. When you've lived as long as I, you'll see that every human being has his shell, and that you must take the shell into account. By the shell, I mean the whole envelope of circumstances. There's no such thing as an isolated man or woman. We're each of us made up of some cluster of appurtenances. What shall we call ourself? Where does it begin? Where does it end? It overflows into everything that belongs to us, and then it flows back again. I know a large part of myself is in the clothes I choose to wear. I've a great respect for things. Oneself, for other people, is one's expression of oneself, and one's house, one's furniture, one's garments, the books one reads, the company one keeps. These things are all expressive." Unquote. Still quoting James, "That was very metaphysical. Not more so, however, than several observations Madame Merle had already made. Isabel was fond of metaphysics, but was unable to accompany her friend into this bold analysis of human personality." Quote Isabel, "I don't agree with you. I think," this is the American talking, very predictably, "I think just the other way. I don't know whether I succeed in expressing myself, but I know that nothing else expresses me. Everything's, on the contrary, a limit, a barrier, and a perfectly arbitrary one. Certainly the clothes, which, as you say, I choose to wear, don't express me, and heaven forbid they should." "You dress very well," Madame Merle lightly interposed. "Possibly, but I don't care to be judged by that. My clothes may express my dress, but they don't express me. To begin with, it's not my choice I wear them. They're imposed upon me by society. Should you prefer to go without them? Madame Merle inquired in a tone which virtually terminated the discussion. Here again, a very classic kind of contrast between the American insistence on self-definition, independence, freedom from social form, being able to be your own person, to express yourself in any way you like, not to be hemmed in by the social forms and conventions, and Madame Merle pointing out that without these social forms and conventions, you don't know who you are. Your nature is so deeply interwoven into them that it's a complete naive illusion to think of yourself as being capable of standing apart from them. Think of all of the various aspects of your own life that are a matter of inheritance, from the kind of family you live in, from what ethnic group it is, what religion, what race, what area of the country, what time in history. How much of that could have been different, and that none of it was up to you. You've gotten this far, and all of that that is you is not picked by you, and you probably intuitively feel like Isabel. That's just a restriction that I'll get rid of later when I figure out who I really am, and I become that person. That's what Isabel is trying to do. And Madame Merle is issuing this vague European caution. You can't do that. You know, it'd be like trying to live without clothes. Well, it sets the scene for the problem of meaning, that is, this instability in how we're understanding ourselves. And I mean this in a very general sense. The traditional social terms we use to account for each other have begun to lose a shared significance. The role of money, for James, is one of the main reasons this has begun to happen, because money, with its sudden shift in social power that it can give people, has changed the kind of regular fixed expectations that our old categories for understanding ourselves were made up of. We see this in our own world in a much more dramatic way than James could have possibly imagined in a celebrity or consumer culture, that the value or worth of a thing James saw being, in a way, changed by enormous amounts of new money, we see changed by media culture or consumption. That values rise and fall so rapidly that we really have no way of understanding in some fundamental way what the common terms of engagement with each other are. And Isabel is going to walk right into that situation. I mean, this is so, in a way, difficult in James that sometimes his thesis is almost that even though we can formulate a view, we're not even sure what we think we're doing, who we are, until we see it reflected by another. And even then, we have to be careful, because the other that we're using as a kind of base for our own perception is self-interested, sometimes has their own agenda, and can be lying. And that's exactly what happens to Isabel, in a way. She believes, in a very typical, for James, American way, that the purity of her intention, and she is a woman of substance. She has a lot of integrity. She doesn't BS. She's a person of substance. And she's convinced that that's what you need in life, period. And she walks right into an enormously complicated trap, just by virtue of her moral goodness. You know, Isabel is full of confidence in her own ideas, and full of confidence, too, that just by sticking to your principles, you'll be fine. But Isabel, in a way, as James begins to indicate, doesn't even understand her own principle. She has a jumble of ideas, as we'll see when her character is described. Okay, let me talk a little bit about the novel, because I want to leave enough time for discussion. The plot of the novel is a fairly simple three-part structure. There's the setup to the marriage. Isabel arrives in England, carried by her aunt, and comes to Gardencourt to meet Ralph and Mr. Touchett. The setup concludes with two refusals of a marriage proposal, one from Lord Warburton, a comic character who thinks of him, this very interesting character, he thinks of himself as being with it, on the cutting edge of liberal political thought. He's an old, comes from inherited wealth in England, and he's convinced that he's got these progressive ideas in his grasp, and he thinks they're quite interesting. But, and again, we have another example of a character who doesn't even understand how little he understands. his actual political views are about as insightful as his two dim-witted sisters. But it never occurs to him that he doesn't even begin to grasp the political situation he thinks he understands. She declines marriage to him, and she declines marriage to an American, to an old European family and to a new rich American family. And James is, as you know, wonderful with names. This is one of his best ones, Caspar Goodwood, as a reflection of both American virility as well as American maleness. And Caspar is nothing if not an archetypal American male. He's always sort of strutting around and boasting and insisting and demanding and manipulating and you know, let me fix this for you, that kind of person. And could be played to great comic effect in a movie if you were played that way. So the setup, she comes, she turns down the marriages, she inherits a load of money, an enormous amount of money. I saw somewhere a calculation of what £70,000 in today's dollars is, several hundreds of millions of dollars that is just dropped on her. The middle of the book, the marriage itself, she becomes infatuated with Osmond, they marry and begin their life together in Italy. The last third of the book, she finds out that the marriage is a sham, that Madame Merle and Osmond had been lovers, that Pansy is Madame Merle's daughter, as well as Osmond's, and that she'd been set up so that Osmond would have her fortune and Pansy would have a huge dowry. And then there's, in the third part, the aftermath, how she reacts to this. Actually, this structure is a very common one in James, and is actually a kind of fairy tale structure. That is, there's the fragile, vulnerable heiress, the princess. There's the suitor, the fortune hunter, and there's the deceiving friend. And in this case, it's Isabel is the princess, Osmond is the fortune hunter, and Madame Merle is the deceiving friend. In Washington Square, in the Golden Bowl, in the Wings of the Dove, there's constantly repetitions of this theme of a woman with money made vulnerable to males, befriended falsely by another woman. Very common in James. A lot of speculation about what he thought that meant or why he structured so many books around it. But what's interesting to me is, again, the moral dimensions of the problem. You've got a woman who is deceived into doing something she would not do, and particularly in a way that's quite offensive to us, deceived by someone she takes to be a friend. Well, the beginning of the novel, I gather you talked a little bit about last week. It's late afternoon. All of these, in James, all of these temporal and spatial elements obviously are connected to this dying European culture, beginning new modern American culture theme. It's great afternoon at a great old English estate, now owned by an American, one of the great estates in England, now owned by an American. And as the sun sets, we see, as if framed in a still portrait, a dying old man, Mr. Touchett, his dying son, Ralph, and a pseudo-radical, pompous English friend, clearly a sort of dying breed, Lord Warburton. The dying young man, Ralph, is said not to care. He hasn't found anything worth caring about in the world he lives in. He's become a cynic. And like many people in 19th and 20th century European fiction, he seems to be dying, to be sick, because of not having found anything to care about. Great theme of Thomas Mann, many other novelists of this period. The marriage between Ralph's father and mother is almost completely loveless, produced only Ralph, and he's dying. And they have great hopes for what they call this tall girl in a black dress, whom they soon see, Mrs. Touchett's niece, the American. They're not sure what she'll be like, but they know that something is coming, some great blast of fresh air. They're very afraid that she will be like her friend, that the future looks like Henrietta Stackpole. The quote is, "Henrietta, however, does smell of the future. It almost knocks one down." Henrietta represents the kind of nightmare vision of pragmatic, sensible, practical Americans who have no taste for anything, who have only the most utilitarian and practical demand. If you're reading through the novel, and whenever Henrietta comes into the book, you can expect, like a Shakespeare play, a comic moment, because Henrietta is mostly treated as a comic character, as the epitome of the danger on the American side of sensibleness. All she wants is a good job, sensible pair of shoes, place to come home to at night. Life is really fairly simple. No grace, no beauty, no adventure, no nobility, no risk, nothing beyond the normal, standard, pragmatic, practical, don't major in philosophy in college, you can't do anything with it, you know, major in electrical engineering, that kind of thing. The great sort of European view of the American view of education. Well, Henrietta is it. She's the European nightmare about the Americans. But what's clear in these Europeans imagistically is that James thinks that this insistence on a kind of form of taste has, although it still seems to be alive, died. And the way he keeps impressing that on you is by impressing on you this issue of sterility. I mean, first of all, the Touchetts have this one dying son. Isabel has a baby. Again, I'm sorry for ruining the plot. The baby dies. Countess Gemini. It's all right, we don't get attached to it or anything, so it's not sad. We meet her and then we find out she had one and it died. As if to make this point about the lack of any morally generative power in this culture. It doesn't have the ability to generate ideals that its young people will adhere to. It merely perpetuates a kind of empty rhythm of civilizational practices. And to emphasize this, I'm saying James keeps telling us that they can't have babies. That there's nothing coming out of them. If you've read far enough to meet Countess Gemini, another one of the great comic characters in James, Osmond's sister, who is a philanderer bar none. She apparently had more affairs than one can even count. She's had three babies. They've all died. James wants to even make fun of his own image a little bit. Well, into this sort of stale picture, this garden, you know, at the end of the day, with a dying old man and his dying son and a dying breed, as the sun sets, in comes Isabel Archer, an extremely fresh, unintimidated young woman, the kind of woman that would be played by Jean Arthur in the 30s and 40s Capra movies, you know, a kind of extremely self-confident, unintimidated, new voice. How did she get to be like that? Why is she different from Henrietta? Very simple story. Her father was a very bohemian fellow. Mother died, father was a very bohemian fellow, and was a gambler. And she had the good fortune to be taken back and forth across the Atlantic to Europe three times before she was 12. She's had exposure to other cultures, other civilizations, and she's escaped the fate of most American girls. She hasn't been socialized to be a Ludlow, the family name. You can sort of see by the sound of it what James thinks of these people. The Ludlows, you know, the lugheads, the dolts that live in Albany and think of their life as having, you know, some sort of perfection. Her bohemian background has broken the hold on that. It's very important to remember that as you go through. Because first, she seems like such an admirable character that you're going to be taken in by her, if you haven't been already. She's certainly the most admirable character in the book. But she is a tissue of half-baked ideas and unformed thoughts and kind of riotous independence. She hasn't had anybody to talk to in Albany about the book she cares about and so forth. And you can imagine what she's been like for the local boys of Albany. There's a passage where James describes their view of her. Her reputation of reading a great deal hung about her like the cloudy envelope of a goddess in an epic. Young men feared that some special preparation was required for talking with her. All this even though she still reads in translation. You know, James trying to get you a sense that she's getting all this through her own filter, this independence, this jumble of ideas. But she knows she doesn't want to come to Europe to settle down right away with Warburton. So when she receives this honor to be, I mean, the estate is supposed to be spectacular and so forth, she refuses it, and the reason she gives is, again, very American. She doesn't want yet to give up her independence. She wants her freedom, which in a way raises the issue of the kind of moral value that will finally emerge in the novel as extremely important. That is, not limiting or abusing in some way another person's freedom, which is what's been done to her. But here, it's just introduced in a kind of ambiguity. The first telegram that comes from Mrs. Touchett saying they're coming says, coming, two nieces, very independent, or coming with niece, very independent. And they immediately ask the question that the book really has at its core, does she mean that in a financial sense or a moral sense? Does she like not to follow each other's views, or does she have enough money to lead her own life? And you can see right away the connection that James is really heartless about pointing out. There's no romance in James, no romantic view of redemption. To lead an interesting life in the emerging modern world, you have to have money. You cannot be an artist in a garret or a simple farmer enjoying the beauty of nature. There's none of that in James. He takes full on the world we've created. And the world we've created will not allow you to lead an interesting life. You might lead a peaceful life. If you like farm animals, you may lead a relatively stable life. But you will not lead an interesting life in the world James presents in his novels without money. And he doesn't shirk from that. The characters who desperately want money are not simply portrayed as greedy. And what happens to Isabel is meant for us to experience not just as a windfall about money, but as a way of opening her life, which in this world would never be possible without 70,000 pounds. And it's a way, it's supposed to be, because this romantic view of money is what the fantasy of most people brought up in this culture have. We'd like to have a lot of money. We don't want to work all our lives to get it. We'd like to have it now. All of us. Inevitably. I mean, we wouldn't give it back. We wouldn't say, well, I'm just not worthy of it. We want to inherit it, to marry it, to find it, to gamble it into our lives, or in some other way to have it after about 5 minutes worth of thinking about getting it would be the best. And James is with you. There's no sort of moral dirtiness about money. Just the opposite. To lead an interesting life, to be free enough to do what your imagination and your taste could lead you to do, requires money. But that's a tragedy in James. That's a tragedy, because the kinds of things you both have to do to get the money and the kinds of problems you inherit with the money, that is to say, the perception of you that is forever altered by having money, is not something which by willpower you can control. And that's Isabel's mistake. She thinks, all right, I have this money, but I'm going to prove to the world and to myself that I'm not subject to it. I'm going to do something irrational. I'm going to take my money and marry the one person in the world everybody is going to tell me not to marry. It's a crazy view, but you can imagine her in a way desperate to have a kind of identity that's her own. Not just to slip back into the she married well, Warburton or Goodwood. You got to remember, those are her options, and they're meant to be alternatives we're supposed to think of as very typical of the kinds of things a woman in her station, with her, especially now with her wealth, would be allowed to marry into. And other than that, you know, a kind of finding a, you know, somebody on a ship that she doesn't. That business is out. She can marry either a lord or she can marry a captain of American industry. And what she's trying to do is prove, in a way this turns out to be a demonstration of exactly the opposite, that the money doesn't have her, she has it. So she picks somebody everybody will say is a bum, a fortune hunter, somebody with no money, a man who looks all day long at various coins, a collector. That's the person she wants to marry, as if to prove that her independence has not been in any way crimped by her money. She keeps saying she can't escape her fate, she must be free, she'll follow her fate. Like her father, she's a gambler. Playing it safe is selling out. That's her view. I'm not going to marry either one of these bozos. I mean, have a life in Albany with Casper Goodwood. What the hell is that? I want something my own. So she ends up married to the most conformist, sterile, manipulative SOB James ever created. There's nobody in James's fiction worse than Osmond. And this, one of his best female characters, if not the best, ends up married to him forever. So he clearly is portraying what he sees as a kind of tragedy, a box that she can't get out of and can't live without getting into. And one of the sort of central issues in the middle sections of the novel is how she comes to think that and why she is so captured by not being captured by anything, by wanting to prove her freedom. Henrietta asks her once, do you know where you're drifting? Henrietta, of course, regards Osmond as pond scum, doesn't want her to have anything to do with Osmond, quite rightly. And Isabel says no, was asked, do you know where you're drifting? I haven't the least idea. I find it very pleasant not to know. A swift carriage of a dark night, rattling with four horses over roads that one can't see, that's my idea of happiness. I mean, one has to ask oneself, is that your idea of happiness? To have an adventure. I mean, right now, everyone thinks of their future life as plotted out in various steps. You probably have some image, or three or four images. Could go this way, could go that way. Would you like the image of just something suddenly happening? Somebody rich fell in love with you and took you away from all this, and you ended up in Bora Bora or the south of Italy, or, and then next year somebody else. Would that be attractive? Would it be interesting? It's a modern fantasy of a sort that we're all, in a way, prey to, susceptible to, because the conventions of the kind of market society we've created are very rigid, in a way more rigid and predictable socially, if not in terms of economic class, than the aristocratic society Elizabeth, Isabel is throwing aside. Work, thrift, prudence, family. Watch as you read through the novel. Does Isabel ever talk about what she imagines her family will be, her children? Never. Why not? She's a bohemian. She is not interested in a middle-class, peaceful existence. She knows she is not like other people, and she's right. She's extremely imaginative, strong-willed, independent, and highly intelligent. And the question is, where is the right place for her? Question for her, in the kind of world she inhabits. And she thinks, going back about two centuries to 15th, 16th century Rome, Florence, or Venice, and recreating a life there, it with Osmond, with somebody who seems to have no settled bourgeois middle-class place, would be the way to go. So she gets her money, she marries Osmond. I mean, there's so many interesting side themes in all of this that are quite worth talking about. One to notice particularly is her relation to Ralph, the son of Mr. Touchett, who gives her the money, who's dying. And as he says, puts a little wind in her sail by giving her this money. Mr. Touchett is very wary. Why do you want to do that? And in a way, it's a kind of figurative question about the Americans. These people are too young to have that much money. It's like, he says, pouring gasoline on an open flame. And he doesn't just mean Isabel. I mean, he thinks he means the new masters of the universe in the early 20th century, the Americans. Everybody with any sense was like Mr. Touchett, the elder, afraid that they were going to take over the planet without having any idea of what they were going to do with it. And Isabel is a sort of nice way of thinking through what is most admirable to James about Americans and what is most dangerous. And of course, the real issue in the novel is what one makes of the end of it. Well, towards the end of the middle section, Isabel realizes many things. Osmond is an egotist, vain, pompous, false, a phony, and that since she will not bend completely to his will, he has ceased to like her, and he will be cold, angry, and petulant the rest of her life. There's no doubt about this. This is the all-time grudge holder of English fiction, Osmond. There's clearly no marriage therapy in the future for them. They're finished. Osmond has felt himself deceived. His wife has ideas, ridiculous ideas that she won't give up. We're led to believe some of them have something to do with religion. She won't apparently convert to Catholicism, which of course Osmond did in moving to, or was in moving to Europe. She won't accept the kind of life that Osmond insists. She wants to be, to some extent, her own person. She learns that, as I said, Madame Merle has acted deceptively and manipulatively, holding from her the information that she was Osmond's lover, and that Pansy, whom they all now have begun to interact with, is her daughter. And that money played a great role in Madame Merle's early friendship with Isabel. With her, hurts her tremendously. This is the, we're led to believe, she had no women friends in Albany. When her aunt finds her, I mean, she's a heroine to me, she's in a room alone reading philosophy. German philosophy, Stephen said. And Mrs. touch it in a sense that throw that stuff away and come with me. I'll show you real life, not that. And she puts it down, never reads another book the rest of the novel. But we're supposed to believe that her life in the life of an intellectual, ambitious woman in Albany, New York, was not good. It was miserable. She had no women friends. Here's Madame Merle, the most cultivated, experienced, sophisticated 35, 40-year-old she's ever met. And it turns out that the great, in a way, female love of her life is a manipulator and a deceiver. And mainly was interested in her money. Well, this scene, if you haven't got to it yet, the scene where she thinks it through, we were talking about this before the talk. Some of you, have you ever seen the movie Portrait of a Lady? Couple? Well, there's a scene in the book that's made for the movie that they don't use. As the three of them begin to interact, Isabel for a while has no clue that something between Madame Merle and Osmond had gone on in the past. But one day she comes home early and turns the corner of an open porch where the two of them are there. And Osmond is sitting down and Madame Merle is standing. And this is, in a way, an ironic exhibition of how the old form meaning still have some sense. That's far too intimate. Two people who had not been sleeping together would never, ever, ever stand and sit that way. The man would always be standing and the woman would always be sitting. To be seated in the presence of a woman is, in a way, a virtual confession of an adulterous affair. The social rules were that fixed. You can see what a great movie scene this would have been. She turns the corner of the camera, you know, a big close-up, just this little flicker of anxiety. And, you know, not knowing how to make anything of it. And that would begin the process that the Countess Gemini finally finishes off when she tells her the story, but I gather in the movie she gets everything handed to her by Osmond's sister, who tells her the story of Madame Merle and Osmond. It's very important that she come to a great deal of this on her own, but apparently that wasn't in the mind of the director. There's another scene where Touchett, Ralph, sees her in Rome, or I believe at a party in Venice, when she's become Mrs. Osmond, and he sees what's happened to her for the first time, and he says the following, "Poor human-hearted Isabel, what perversity had bitten her? Her light step drew a mass of drapery behind it." She's in one of these enormous Italian gowns. "Her intelligent head sustained a majesty of ornament." This incredibly intelligent, intellectual girl is walking around with a dress that goes 6 feet behind her and 2 feet up. The free, keen girl had become quite another person. What he saw was the fine lady who was supposed to represent something. What did Isabel represent? Ralph asked himself, and he could only ask her by saying that she represented Gilbert Osmond. Good heavens, what a function, he then woefully exclaimed. He was lost in wonder at the mystery of things. Well, I'll jump, so we'll have some time for a discussion to the end of the novel and the controversy about it. Defend the kind of thesis I want to represent to you, namely that James's view of morality is deeply intertwined with his understanding of modern moral meaning, of the dependence we have on each other for our trusting what we're doing being what we think we're doing, and the necessity of free people, not manipulated people, for us to get the right reaction from the world. It's a large thesis I can't defend, but I think James is playing around with a much deeper understanding of the nature of our dependence, what we owe each other, another way of talking about morality. What we owe each other just by showing up, not by virtue of what we've promised, but just by virtue of being what we owe each other. That James has a marvelously complex and interesting view of that, informed by a very serious and sophisticated analysis of the nature of the modern world and the role of money in it. That's the claim. But at the end of the novel, something happens. It's another reason I wanted to write the book. I disagreed with everybody I had read. She finds out he's a rat. And he says, "Well, all right, whatever you think, I'm a rat, but I'm your husband, shut up, go get the groceries," or whatever, or the equivalent of that in Venice. And so she does for a while, because Osmond tries very, very hard, once he realizes that Lord Warburton was the suitor, said in those days the lover of Isabel, wanted to marry her, realizes he has a great chance to marry Pansy, his own daughter, to Warburton, because he's in love with Isabel, and will marry Pansy so he can be around Isabel. Osmond's reaction? Great. Great. We'll get him to marry Pansy and get his dowry. I'll be even richer. I mean, the fact that the reason Warburton would marry Pansy has nothing whatsoever to do with Pansy. Doesn't ever cross his mind. Another instance where we're supposed to feel a kind of indignation. The novel won't work unless we feel outrage that he's manipulating his own daughter to get more money. Isabel is very worried about what's going to happen with Pansy. Ralph, who's dying finally for good, issues a bedside call. Osmond says, don't go. If you go, you are nothing to me, you know, that kind of thing. I no longer have a wife if you go. She goes, naturally, it's Isabel. Ralph says, you gotta leave her. You gotta leave him now. This is terrible. You've got one life, you can't waste it with him. She says, well, you know, basically, I don't know. I've got Pansy to think about. So Goodwood gets wind of this, rushes to the scene, and now that she's back in Garden Court, and there's a final scene near the very end of the novel where Goodwood finally, you know, in sort of heroic American movie style, grabs Isabel and kisses her. And I think we're supposed to believe it's the first time ever Isabel has been kissed with passion. And there's a kind of, I think the phrase is, white lightning shimmers through the scene. And the prose describing it is among the most intricate and beautiful of James's prose, so I won't try to summarize it. But she breaks free, turns around and runs away. Now, the traditional reading is that James is a psychological novelist. He's very, very good at representing the inner states of people and how they think and feel. And what we're supposed to take this to mean is that she is afraid of experiencing for the first time a kind of genuine human sensuality, real human life, not the ideas that Isabel had always used to interpret the world around her, but for the first time this sort of brutish young man has made her feel what real physical passion is, and she's terrified. That seems to me completely wrong. I think it's very serious in the novel that Pansy, who is, you know, about to leave the convent, is under the control of a manipulative monster. And that she, when she left Pansy, Pansy's last words were, you're coming back. She said, yes, do you promise? Yes, I promise. But what strikes me is, so I think the ending of the novel reflects a kind of moral maturity on the part of Isabel. She doesn't think anymore that a great adventure will set her free, that running away with the white knight on the horse back to the castle is the way life works. And particularly what strikes me about the common interpretation of the end of the novel is that she would be marrying Goodwood, this boob, and going back to Albany. And here she's got a house in Venice, a house in Florence, a house in Rome, a house in London, an estate in London. And what she's being asked to do is go back and be a housewife in Albany. And I think most of the critical literature on James just doesn't take account of the fact of how ridiculous that option would be. People are so interested in turning the novel into a kind of sensual drama for Isabel at the end. But I think it would need another hour to even begin to defend that. You'll make up your own mind when you get to the end, if you haven't already. But it's the question of the book, the question the book really wants to ask. When Isabel refuses Goodwood, is it because she's afraid and is retreating into a kind of self-deceived moralism? Or is there a kind of genuine maturity in Isabel, where she's finally breaking free of the fantasy of what an interesting life could be, perhaps tragically, given her potential? But I should stop so we have time for some questions.
Do you think an American in this culture war between America and Europe can win in a sense of merging somehow, melding somehow with the traditions of Europe? Because virtually everyone who tries loses in some way. And then that brings up the question of Isabel as a heroic character or not, in the way she's represented and ultimately what happens to her at the end. If she's heroic, then in effect, if she makes your interpretation of a decision to go back and do the dutiful thing, is she a tragic figure?
I think she is a tragic figure, and I don't think he thinks the European tradition in all of its social manifestation. I mean, there's a whole separate issue we haven't talked about, and that's his view of the artist, of the moral value of art in general, in James, is another issue. But in terms of the social forms of Europe, particularly this notion of inherited class privilege, arranged marriages, and a kind of super formalism in social relations that don't allow anything but the most expected and rule-based reaction is a kind of living death. I don't think he thinks there's any redemption. He's a good American in that respect. But his fear is that America will not be able to develop quickly enough of our own traditions and sort of embedded social meaning in our lives to give us the kind of guidance we need intuitively in life fast enough. That won't happen fast enough. And we'll be characters like Henrietta, extremely self-righteous and convinced of our superiority in a way that's true, but way too smug, without any sense of that a rich, long tradition, which is nothing but really a series of examples that everyone remembers, can shed light on the corners and ambiguities. Americans don't have that yet. James was convinced they'd get it, but he wasn't sure they'd get it before they blew up the planet, or ruined it, or something like it, or polluted it to death, or sooner or later something analogous will develop in the American sense of being an American. It will mean something.
But so then there's an abyss between the European and the American culture, and neither essentially has something for the other at this stage.
Certainly, I'd say the best thing to read on his, and really one of the great reads in James, is a book called What Maisie Knew, one of the best titled works, which is the clearest picture of the ugliness of European aristocratic life. When James wants to make that point, he always uses children. And Maisie is a child who is the victim. In a way, it's the first novel about what has become a depressingly familiar form of post-marital life, where there's a tremendous fight to the death between the parents, but not over who gets the child, but who has to take the child. And one of the first novels about that is What Maisie Knew, I have to say. You guys are brave. You're starting with one of the more difficult books. Portrait of a Lady is often recommended as the first tough one, once you've got a few under your belt. If you like it and you want to jump way into the maelstrom, try the last three, the Ambassadors, the Golden Bowl, and the Wings of the Dove. You think this prose is difficult. James sort of outdoes himself in his last... He lived for 10 years after he finished the last one. He seemed to have just exhausted himself in the complexity of the prose. But if you're sort of in favor of this one, then What Maisie Knew or The American? It's a very clear book about an American in Europe and the first sort of clear evocation of this theme. And it's very funny and it's very easy to read. Yeah, Portrait is a tough go.
I have to disagree with you about your description of Isabella. Mm-hmm. Or Isabel. I thought she was as vain, as egotistical, as superficial as Osmond. They deserved one another because she came off as not being that way, and yet deep inside, she was always mentally manipulating what was going to be best for her, knowing that she was superior, and she always wanted to advance herself and was using other people to learn and expand her own horizons. And there was a part where even compassion, it was a benefit to the giver. I mean, she was really ugly. I can't hold her up as a model.
Well, she is pretty hard. You've got to remember, she's pretty hard on herself. When she goes through that long scene by the fire at night, one of the things she's most frustrated by is that she can't simply be angry at Osmond. In a way, he wasn't false. He was on the surface what he was, a superficial false aristocrat. He didn't pretend to be anything else. He didn't pretend to have money, influential friends, social power. He pretended to be indifferent to everything. She said the only thing he ever wanted to be was the Pope. He had ambitious social dreams. But he wanted to, the only reason he was so sort of contemptuous of the world is it wasn't worthy enough to reflect his own glory back to him. So when she's thinking about what she's done, she says, maybe the one who's false here was me. I pretended to be a kind of woman that he would like. In a way, that's part of the drama of all romance, when people are courting each other. The difference between trying very hard to be who you really are in the right light so the person will love you versus trying very hard simply to look like who you think they'll like is a thin one. So she's a little hard on herself because the game of courtship is a theatrical game. You want the person to like you because you're in love with them. So you become someone that you convince yourself is really you in another way. So she's very hard on herself, and I think that endears us to her. When we see that long scene at the end, she realizes many of the things James, as the narrator, has been telling us. She really doesn't have a lot of well-thought-out ideas. She's kind of vain. She, you know, there, at one point Warburton says, you know, there might be a revolution in this country. She says, oh, I hope there's a revolution. That would be so much fun to see. Which is fatuous. You're quite right. But I think our, and maybe we'll disagree about this too, but that's what the book is for, the turning point in the scene at the fireplace, she becomes really very honest with herself in a way that Madame Merle or Osmond never were. So I think she gains some in our estimation, even though throughout particularly the courtship with Osmond, she was an image of herself, not herself, even though her great ideal was authenticity.
Well, the redeeming quality, I think, at the end of the book, I really wanted to imagine that she would go back, she would fight with Osmond for the child, and she really whoop him.
Well, you have another book in mind.
She had the strength to do it if she had the mind and the perseverance.
I think we're supposed to believe that, and where we're supposed to feel the horror of this, you know, $800 million, it's gone. Once she marries Osmond, the male has all the money.
I didn't get that.
Yeah, well, that's,
I thought she was still in control of it.
No, once, I mean, this is one of the great sort of liberating aspects of modern democratic American life. We no longer have this. But marriages, there were no prenuptial agreements. Once you sign, once you're married, the husband controls the estate, and the husband's male, first male heir is the inheritor. And if it's not a male heir, then it's Pansy. And so Pansy is going to get an enormous endowment, $200-300 million, to whoever marries her. And remember, our hearts are supposed to be tugged by Pansy because of the Ned Rozier, this guy who falls in love with her. She's supposed to have a life of her own. As James keeps trying to show us, what indifference to the entitlement that a free subject has to be treated like one means in the world. For Pansy, it means an arranged marriage with Warburton, unless Isabel can stop it. But she can't get her money back, not with the divorce laws of that age. Madame Merle's not even divorced yet. You know, there's a husband back in the background there. I mean, these women and men who separate just go the rest of their lives in independence, but the man keeps the money.
There was a lie about Merle. I thought that was covering up her affair with Osmond.
She certainly has an affair with Osmond, but she has a long checkered past.
She actually is married then.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Plus, I'm remembering another book. I think she's married.